3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Five, four, three, two, one.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
Welcome to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. My name is Ian McIntyre. The first talk we'll be hearing today regards the campaign to defend Aboriginal rights from 1946 to 1949. The speaker is Nick Everett, who in 2016 completed a Masters of Human Rights at Curtin University, with a research focus on the 1946 Pilbara strike, the Communist Party, and the struggle for Aboriginal rights.
The strike itself was officially launched on May Day, the 1st of May 1946, and it was the longest recorded strike in Australian history at the time. The strikers' demands were straightforward: a 30 shilling per week minimum wage, the right to elect their own representatives, and freedom of movement. Yet for Aboriginal workers in Australia's northwest, their actions directly challenged Western Australia's Aborigines Act 1905 and its successor, the Native Administration Act 1936, which together controlled every aspect of Aboriginal people's lives. The Pilbara Aboriginal workforce thus defied not only the pastoral station owners by demanding better wages and conditions, but also sought to win independence from a regime of colonial servitude. I think it's worth saying in this introduction to something about the timing of the strike. The idea of the strike came about in 1942 at a meeting of Aboriginal elders throughout the northwest that took place in Skull Springs. Present at that meeting was Don McLeod, the only white man present, who was a union militant and at the time in the periphery of the Communist Party. And the Communist Party's attitude at that point in the midst of World War II was a cautious one. The Communist Party leadership were not in favour of leading strikes in the midst of World War II, but instead advocated essentially all support to the war effort. However, at the end of World War II, we saw pent-up frustrations amongst Australia's workforce more broadly, particularly unionised sections of the workforce, and a strike wave emerge in the period 46 to 49, corresponding with the Pilbara strike. So although the strike officially ended in 1949, much of the workforce never returned, instead building self-sufficient communities through cooperative mining and other ventures. Their struggle inspired a national campaign for Aboriginal rights, spearheaded in Perth by the Committee for the Defence of Native Rights, which will be my focus in this talk. Much has been written about the strike. Some of the Aboriginal communities in the Pilbara that were engaged with the strike, spreading from the coastal Port Hedland right into the sandy desert towards Marble Bar, Nullagine. So quite a diverse array of Aboriginal communities. Within the Great Sandy Desert region, there are 20 different Aboriginal language groups, and they in turn have cultures, language different from the Aboriginal communities in the hinterland around Port Hedland. The Yamatji people are the people from Port Hedland along the coast south of there. So much has been written, as I said, about the strike, looking at its evolution into a land rights struggle, and particularly about the cooperative ventures that followed in its wake that appeared to offer some alternative to the dominant assimilationist ideology and rhetoric of Australian governments at the time. Michael Hess has examined its significance as an industrial struggle. Anne Scrimger has focused on the role of Aboriginal domestic workers within the strike. In this paper, I'll focus on the solidarity campaign led by the Committee for the Defence of Native Rights, which I'll call CDNR, based here in Perth, and supported by the West Australian Labor Movement. From its inception, the CDNR was dismissed by the Commissioner for Native Affairs, Francis Bray, as a communist front. Yet over the course of the dispute, the CDNR adopted several strategies that proved remarkably successful in galvanising public support for the strike and assisting the Aboriginal strikers' efforts to pressure pastoral station employers and state government officials to concede their demands. A legal defence was mounted to defend those jailed, and all available avenues were used to publicise the strike. Strike funds were raised, and perhaps most significantly, industrial bans were imposed on wool exports to extract concessions from pastoral station owners. It will be argued here that the CDNR and Labor Movement solidarity with the strike was a significant precursor to the Aboriginal civil rights and land rights movements that followed in subsequent decades. So I'm going to start here by looking at a public meeting that took place in Perth, 19th of May 1946, just 3 weeks into the strike. At the Perth Esplanade was the site of a 200-strong solidarity demonstration. And the Perth Esplanade in the Depression era was the site of many public protests by the radical left in Perth. The protest demanded the immediate release of two of the strike leaders, Clancy McKenna and Dooley Binbin, who were arrested at the strike's commencement on the charge of enticement to strike. Those gathered were outraged by the jailing and cruel treatment of strike leaders under a Labor state government. The audience were informed that Dooley had been chained to the neck for 6 days while in remand in Marble Bar Jail, and along with McKenna, sentenced to 3 months with hard labour. Participants called on the Justice Minister to revoke the sentences and free the imprisoned strike leaders and to secure the withdrawal of charges laid against Don McLeod, the strikers' representative, who I mentioned before was a white Labor militant who by this time had joined the Communist Party. Recognising whose interests the laws really served, their resolution declared, "We consider that the Native Administration Act is administered not for the benefit of the natives, but for the squatters or pastoralists to provide them with a supply of cheap labour." 2 days later, a small group met at the offices of the Society of Friends, or Quakers, at Chancery House in Howard Street, Perth, forming the Provisional Committee for the CDNR. A leaflet authored by Catherine Susanna Pritchard urged members of trade unions, women's organisations, religious and other bodies to prevent the continuation of glaring injustice which strikes at the principles of living in which Australia stands. By attending a public meeting at Perth Town Hall on the following Tuesday, 28th of May. So that night, 28th of May, was a stormy night. 300 people turned out to launch the CDNR in Perth Town Hall. Speakers included the author, Catherine Susanna Pritchard, representing the Modern Women's Club, Mrs. Valance from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, Mr. Payne from the Tramways Union, Mr. Foxcroft from the Quakers, and Communist Party organiser Graham Alcorn. However, the most enthusiastic welcome was reserved for Noongar elder and activist Tommy Brofo, who told the meeting, "Today we are demanding at least similar privileges to the white man and our freedom. These concessions have been too long delayed." The meeting resolved to contact for support all trade unions and people's organisations and societies in Australia and international organisations which stand for the defence of native people, including, if necessary, the UNO, the term at the time for the United Nations. A committee was elected that included Anglican Minister Peter Hodge as the secretary, medical doctor and communist Alex Jolly as president, Mr. Foxcroft and Don McLeod as vice presidents, women's rights campaigner Irene Greenwood, and Aboriginal activists Tommy Brofo and Mary Morden. Despite the broad base of the committee, the Commissioner for Native Affairs, Francis Bray, informed State Premier Frank Wise that the meeting achieved little except that the communists, and I quote here, except that the communists enlisted some dupes or marionettes for the purpose of communist propaganda. So it gives you a sense of the hostility of the post-war state Labor government to the cause of Aboriginal rights in general, and obviously the anti-communist rhetoric that was being beefed up in the onset of the Cold War. However, the CDNR and affiliated union support soon secured a victory from the state Labor government. 5 weeks in, Clancy and Dooley's 3 months sentence... 5 weeks into Clancy and Dooley's 3 month sentence, Minister Nilsson ordered their immediate release. The reprieve, however, was short-lived. Over the following 3 years, strikers were repeatedly jailed. Well, I want to say a bit here about the Communist Party's role in building with solidarity with the strike, which I think was in many respects quite exemplary at the time. So the Communist Party was in a strong position here for a number of reasons. Firstly, at the time, the only political party in Australia to actively campaign for Aboriginal rights was the Communist Party. From the early 1920s, the party's national newspaper, Workers Weekly, accused pastoral industry employers of chattel slavery, demanded equal wages to Aboriginal workers, and vehemently opposed the North Australian Workers Union's exclusion of Aboriginal workers from its membership. So the Workers Weekly was the party's national publication, printed in Sydney. In 1939, leading communist Tom Wright, federal president of the Sheet Metal Workers Union and vice president of the New South Wales Labor Council, outlined the party's policy on Aboriginal rights in the pamphlet New Deal for Aborigines. The party called for land rights for full-blood Aboriginal people, that's their terminology, special courts for native offences, the abolition of police acting as Aboriginal protectors, and full citizenship rights for all Aboriginal people. In 1943, Communist Party branches in Perth's working-class eastern suburbs campaigned for housing for the Aboriginal fringe dweller community following their eviction from the South Guildford Reserve by the Australian Army. Secondly, in the context of a post-war strike wave, communists were gaining influence within the ranks and leadership of several WA unions. In 1948, two communists won leadership positions based at Fremantle Wharf. Paddy Troy was elected secretary of the Fremantle branch of the Coastal Dock River and Harbour Workers Union, which was the union basically covering wharf labourers, while Ron Hurd was elected secretary of the Fremantle branch of the Seamen's Union. The following year, both were instrumental in imposing a black ban on union crews handling of wool bales awaiting export on the Port Hedland Wharf at a critical juncture in the dispute. However, the CDNR was by no means solely a communist affair. Local Noongar people played an important role in the committee, and I should say here there were Aboriginal members of the Communist Party, though at the time typically mixed descent Aboriginal people active on the left didn't necessarily identify publicly as Indigenous for fairly obvious reasons. So there were local Noongar activists alongside Quakers, Labor Party members and prominent members of the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Methodist Ladies Guild. Aboriginal elders such as Tommy Brofo, Bertha Isaacs and Bill Bodney, as well as younger activists such as Helena Clark and Jack Polland, joined rallies on Perth's Esplanade to demand the release of imprisoned strikers. In 1947, Perth Noongars formed the Coolbaroo League, an Aboriginal-run organisation that began hosting dances each Friday night in East Perth and soon began agitating for Aboriginal civil rights. In the 1950s, the League rented an office from the Carpenters Union in Beaufort Street, that's just this street that we're on, and published a newspaper in the West called the Westralian Aborigine, giving voice to Aboriginal people across the state. And there's a very good film documentary produced about 20 years ago now called the Coolbaroo Club, which covers more of this history. But back to the CDNR. So critical to the success of the CDNR was the Port Hedland-based trade union militant Don McLeod, who represented strikers in their dealings with the Department of Native Affairs. And the Aboriginal workers were basically forced to employ to engage a white representative because they had no legal standing in the industrial courts at the time. Throughout the strike, McLeod maintained close ties with both the CDNR and the Perth-based members of the Communist Party, which he joined in 1944. Worker Star reporter Joan Williams recalled, "By the time the strike was planned, we'd recognised that the Aborigines had to produce their own leaders, so we were elated to hear from McLeod that the people's own councils would debate every move and that outstanding Aboriginal leaders like Clancy McKenna and Dooley had already appeared." At the strike's commencement, Graham Alcorn began communicating with McLeod regarding strategy and tactics, while Williams and Dorothy Hewitt reported on the strike for Workers' Star and Tribune, the Communist Party's national newspaper, the successor of Workers' Weekly. Hewitt's husband, Lloyd Davies, a recent law graduate, and Perth barrister Fred Curran, provided pro bono legal representation for the jailed strikers. Addressing the CDNR launch on the 27th of May, Alcorn recognised that the strike provided the CDNR with an agitational focal point around which a movement can grow from all parts of Australia to bring about a new deal for Aborigines under federal control. So this was a demand launched really around the day of mourning in Sydney that the state systems of apartheid be dismantled and that the federal government enact laws or override essentially the apartheid regimes of the states. At the time of the strike, not only were town centres off-limits to Aboriginal people, but non-Aboriginal people were barred from entering Aboriginal town camps on the outskirts of towns. This enforced segregation presented significant challenges to the Pilbara strikers and their supporters. During the course of the dispute, McLeod was arrested 7 times, 4 times for being within 5 chains, 100 metres of a congregation of natives, and 3 times for inciting natives to leave their lawful employment. In August, Peter Hodge travelled to Port Hedland to visit the 12-mile camp and, much to his surprise, was arrested alongside McLeod. And historian Michael Hess quipped that this was rather ironic that he should be charged with being in cooee of a congregation of natives given his job as a clergyman. So Hodge was fined £10 for his offence, while McLeod was sentenced to 3 months imprisonment. When in October 1946 the WA Court of Criminal Appeal rejected appeals by Clancy, Dooley and McLeod and Hodge against their convictions, the decision aroused public indignation throughout the land, and much support, both material and moral, poured into the CDNR from elsewhere, recalls Davies. The CDNR appealed to the High Court and to the United Nations. Alleging that the strike leaders' arrests amounted to feudal treatment of Aborigines in Northern Australia. The High Court upheld the appeal on the grounds that the intent of the statute was better protection of natives and not criminalisation of McLeod and Hodges' contact with them. So up until this point, the rhetoric of the state government was that these laws were about protecting Indigenous people, when the reality was the reverse. While the victory boosted the strikers' morale and secured publicity for their cause, it did not end punitive legal action against them. In January 1947, McKenna and 12 others were jailed after allegedly preventing several Warragine station hands from working. In August 1947, 12 more Aboriginal men were charged with abduction and jailed for attempting to rescue children suffering abuse on a pastoral station. While mainstream media largely ignored the strike, Workers' Star consistently championed the strikers' cause. Alcorn, Williams and Hewitt worked on the paper from the Communist Party's third floor office in London Court. For people who don't know London Court, it's a Tudoresque more. It actually doesn't look that much different today. Tudoresque on the outside, sort of Art Deco on the inside. It runs between Hay Street through to St George's Terrace. That's looking down towards the terrace, and the Communist Party had an office upstairs on the third floor next to a kitsch chiming clock. According to Davies, the daily newspapers in the other states were forced to rely upon Worker Star for sources of information and often quoted from its articles. Williams recalls that when the Worker Star published a photo of Aboriginal people chained by the neck, it caused public outroar both in Australia and overseas. As news of the strike spread, support poured in. Students at UWA marched in support of the strikers. Messages of support and donations came in from a dozen West Australian Union branches, from some Labor Party branches, women's organisations, and interstate from Queensland, New South Wales and Victorian unions, and the South Australian Council for the Advancement of Aboriginal Women. Additionally, the CDNR appealed to the British Anti-Slavery Society, the World Federation of Trade Unions, the Australian Council of Trade Unions and federal ministers. With donations it received, the CDNR printed and distributed 20,000 copies of a four-page leaflet outlining the history of the strike and the committee's policy on Aboriginal rights. In March 1947, less than a year into the strike, the Liberal Party coalition defeated Labor to form government in Western Australia. The state's new Native Affairs Commissioner, Stanley Middleton, fresh from administering the natives in colonial Papua New Guinea, began advocating a new policy of assimilation of the state's Aboriginal population. There was an eight-year period during World War II in the Labor government where Francis Bray was the then called Native Affairs Commissioner. So A.O. Neville's policies were basically assimilation by extermination, essentially, but a policy of absorption, of breeding out Aboriginality, and the sort of more nuanced policy advocated by Stanley Middleton and taken up at a national level by Hasluck was a cultural assimilationist policy where citizenship for Aboriginal people was something to aspire to, which would be gradually attained over a period of culturalisation of Aboriginal people. So consistent with this policy, Middleton tried a new tack. So he hoped that he could coax the strikers into abandoning their self-managed camps, 12-mile camp, 12 kilometres outside of Port, 20 kilometres outside of Port Hedland, and Mooliella near Marble Bar. He hoped that he could coax out the Aboriginal workers in favour of accepting the charity of the White Springs Mission, recently established with a generous land grant from the state government. But the strikers refused to move. Part of Middleton's policy was to abandon the idea of government-run native settlements, which state government had copped a lot of flack over, and essentially to outsource these to the churches to be run as missions. So the strikers refused to move, and ultimately it was trade union support that helped break the deadlock and secure at least a partial victory for the strikers. When in April 1949, 43 strikers were jailed for enticing natives to strike, the Seamen's Union called for the prisoners' immediate release and threatened a ban on the shipment of wool from stations where slave conditions applied. Their intention was to hit squarely at the hip pockets of the Pilbara wool growers. By mid-June 1949, all but one of 43 convicted strikers had served out their sentences. The state government was hopeful that further strike action could be averted. However, on the 20th of June, police arrested another 10 strikers at Nullagine. The scene was set for a showdown. Ron Hurd, as I mentioned before, the Secretary of the Fremantle branch of the Seamen's Union, convinced his members to implement the wool ban. Bales of wool now sat idle on Port Hedland Wharf, and by mid-July, jailed strikers had all been released. McLeod had little doubt the strike action had precipitated their release. On 15th of July, he told Workers Star, "Intervention of Mr. Elliot Smith, Northern Administrator of Native Affairs, secured the dismissal of the charges and the release of the accused natives." The Seamen's Union declared victory when Smith promised agreements for wages and conditions that matched those of Mount Edgar and Limestone stations, which had already agreed to the strikers' demands. Unfortunately, for reasons of time, I can't say a lot about what happened on Port Hedland Wharf in these months of June and July, but the AWU, which formerly, the officials of the AWU, which formerly represented the wharf labourers on Port Hedland Wharf, were not at all keen on this strike and did their best to undermine it. But the efforts of the seamen basically contributed to determination by the rank and file wharfies at Port Hedland to keep these war bands in place until the Seamen's Union had declared victory. Once the bans were lifted, Native Affairs Minister Ross MacDonald told State Parliament no such agreement had been made, leading McLeod to later conclude that the strike had been defeated, despite many station owners having now conceded to strikers' demands. McLeod, however, did observe that despite the ringleaders having been in and out of jail like clockwork, the blackfellas, term he used, never wilted. Nothing that either the state or police did could shake their solidarity. And Graham Alcorn, Communist Party organiser, said of the strike, when the Pilbara station hand struck, here was a rallying point for all Aboriginal people, a rallying point for all those white people throughout Australia who wanted to do something, a chance to isolate and defeat the reactionary squatters and the government policies they dictated. The CDNR played no small part in the struggle for Aboriginal rights. Alcorn observed that while it was the use of the strike weapon and the strength of organisation among the Pilbara workers themselves that was most decisive, the CDNR's national campaign held the government's hand and enabled the workers to continue their campaign. There were at times sharp debates within the CDNR. Liberals within the committee expressed unease about its close association with communist-led trade unions. By the early 1950s, the campaign had changed its name now to the Native Rights and Welfare League and was focused on welfare support for local Noongars. It adopted the assimilationist approach to Aboriginal affairs now advocated by Middleton. And it should be said of the Communist Party at this point that it was fighting a rearguard defence against Menzies' attempts to ban it by 1951. So it had stepped away from its engagement with the campaign, and the post-war strike wave was over. Nonetheless, Alcorn concluded, had the CDNR not built a powerful solidarity campaign with the Pilbara strikers, there is little doubt that Don and the native leaders would have been jailed indefinitely, their organisation smashed, and the rank and file terrorised back to work. Thanks.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, "Sorry boys, I gained your loss, we're gonna steal your land. If you break down your British law, sure, you're gonna hang. Work your life like a combi, with a chain on your neck and hands." And they taught us, "Whoa, black woman, I shall not steal. Hey, a black man, I shall not steal. Civilize your black barbaric life, and we teach you how to move. But your history couldn't hide the genocide, the hypocrisy that was real. Why our Jesus said, supposed to keep the oppressed, I better do say to you, the white man life shall not steal. Oh, yeah, our land, you better heed. Your science and technology, hey, you can make a nuclear bomb. Development has increased its size.
tongue. If you think that's progress, I suggest your reason is unsound. You should have found out long ago, you best keep it in the ground. The tortoise, whoa, black woman, I shall not steal. I said, hey, yeah, black man, thou shall not steal. We're gonna civilize your black barbaric life, and we teach you how to kneel. Bet your history couldn't hide the genocide. No hypocrisy, there was this reason why your Jesus said you're supposed to give the oppressed a better deal. Consider you, the white man, thou shall not steal. Oh, yeah, land, you'd better heal. Me and Neil and Ribner sitting underneath that Interpilly Bridge, watching that blazing sun go down behind a tall tree, mountain ridge. The land's our heritage and spirit here. The rightful culture's black. We're sitting here just wondering when we're gonna get that land back. They taught us, whoa, black woman, I shall not steal. I said, hey, yeah, black man, thou shalt not steal. We're gonna civilize black barbaric lives, and we teach you. But your history couldn't hide the genocide. The hypocrisy to what you mean. Why our Jesus said, supposed to give the oppressed a better deal. Said to you, the white man, thou shalt not steal. Oh, yeah, our land, you better heal. You talk of conservation, keep the forest pristine green. Yet in 200 years, your materialism has stripped the forest clean. And a racist contradiction that's understood by none. Mostly that left hand holds a Bible, right hand holds a gun. That's, oh, black woman, I shall not steal. Said, hey, black man, thou shalt not steal. We're gonna civilize. And it knew, but your history couldn't hide the genocide. The hypocrisy of what was real. By our Jesus said, you're supposed to keep the oppressed. Let it be. He said to you, your white man, thou shalt not steal. Oh, yeah, our land, you'd better heal.
You've just heard Thou Shalt Not Steal from Kevin Carmody. The track originally appeared on his 1989 album Pillars of Society. Prior to that, we had a talk from Nick Everett discussing support that was given to the 1946 Pilbara strike. The program you're listening to today is Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. The next presentation we'll hear is from Ray Francis, who is the Dean and Professor of History in the College of Arts and Social Sciences at the Australian National University. She discusses the National Action Plan to Combat Human Trafficking and Slavery that the Commonwealth of Australia finalised in 2014, and looks at how this was the outcome of a project to join a whole of Commonwealth government response, together with close coordination with state governments, NGOs and sex worker organisations. She also explores the history of laws and approaches concerning sex work and migration since the late 19th century.
In May 2017, headlines in the Australian media proclaimed, quote, victim of alleged human trafficking held captive in Sydney man's home. The report concerned a 17-year-old girl from West Africa who allegedly travelled to Sydney with a man who offered her work as a cleaner. After arriving in early April, she was kept in a room where she was believed to have been repeatedly sexually assaulted by a number of men. The girl only managed to escape from the house in the early hours of the 27th of April, some weeks later, running until she was picked up by an unknown woman who drove her to the Asylum Seeker Centre in Sydney's Inner West. The teenager was taken to hospital for treatment following consultation with the Anti-Slavery Australian Unit at the University of Technology, Sydney, and was subsequently placed in the care of Family and Community Services. The Australian Federal Police and the New South Wales Police Force pleaded for help from the public to find a man who was described as either a Guinean national or an African male. Now, this case is but one of many cases of alleged sexual servitude that have been reported in Australia since the 1990s. Public interest in such cases has occurred in the context of increased international interest in issues of people trafficking and slavery, especially sex trafficking. 2 months after this press report, the Commonwealth of Australia released the report of an inquiry into trafficking, slavery and slavery-like practices by its Parliamentary Joint Committee on Law Enforcement. The report made a number of recommendations, including that the Commonwealth Government funds the National Action Plan to combat human trafficking and slavery, 2015 to 2019, so that it may be fully implemented with a human rights-based approach to its implementation. This report confirms the direction in which Australian governments have been heading since the late 1990s, when the Commonwealth introduced into the Criminal Code offences relating to slavery, sexual servitude, and deceptive recruiting for sexual services. A series of amendments to the Criminal Code in the 21st century have provided specific offences relating to trafficking in persons, forced labour, forced marriage, and harbouring victims, as well as protections for vulnerable witnesses. State and territory governments, who are responsible for regulating the sex work industry, have also enacted legislation relating to sexual servitude and deceptive recruiting. The National Action Plan, finalised in 2014, represents an attempt to provide a coordinated approach to the issue, bringing together a whole-of-government Commonwealth response, working closely with state governments, NGOs, and sex worker organisations. The aim is to prevent and police trafficking, slavery, and slavery-like practices, as well as to provide appropriate support for the victims of these activities. The coordinated response described in the case of the African girl above reflects just such an approach. This response occurs within the broader context of an international anti-trafficking campaign coordinated by the United Nations. While the scope of the National Action Plan includes all forms of trafficking and slavery, until very recently, the overwhelming focus has been on sex trafficking. Ongoing interest in the 21st century represents only the most recent chapter in what has been a long history of Australian engagement with the issue of sex trafficking, dating to at least the last decades of the 19th century. Now, the purpose of my paper today is to provide a broader historical context for this very live contemporary issue. The history of migrant sex work, sex trafficking, and official responses to these questions sheds light, I believe, on theoretical and policy issues which arise in relation to the conceptualisation of commercial sex and its relationship to migration, trafficking, and slavery today. But first, it's important to be clear about definitions, as much confusion arises from lack of clarity in relation to terminology and concepts, especially the difference between sex trafficking and migrant sex work. The National Action Plan defines human trafficking as, quote, the physical movement of people across or within borders through coercion, threat, or deception for the purpose of exploiting them within when they reach their destination. Where the person is a child, the element of coercion, threat, or deception is not required. So the two key elements are physical movement and coercion, threat, or deception. This definition is a succinct version of a definition given under the UN Protocol to Prevent, Suppress, and Punish Trafficking in Persons, especially women and children, from 2000. The National Action Plan defines slavery as occurring, quote, when a person exercises the rights of ownership over another person. As well as activities that fit this definition, there are a range of slavery-like practices that include servitude, forced labour, deceptive recruiting, debt bondage, and forced marriage. Trafficking is not the same as people smuggling. Key difference is the element of exploitation in the former. While neither the National Action Plan nor the UN Protocol specifically define sex trafficking, this can be understood, I think, as trafficking for the purposes of sexual exploitation. It's important to note, however, that this simple definition conceals a highly contested issue in relation to sex trafficking and migrant sex work. There are two major camps derived from fundamentally different approaches to the meaning of commercial sex. On the one hand, you have those who see the exchange of sexual services for payment as a form of service work. On the other hand, you have those who regard commercial sex as essentially a form of violence against women. In the former, individuals who choose to engage in this activity are seen as workers, meaning those who travel from their home country to engage in the sex industry are regarded as a kind of migrant sex worker. In contrast, when all women who are in the sex industry are viewed as violated and sexually exploited, and that's a quote, any women who travel to another country to engage in the sex industry are regarded as trafficked persons rather than migrant workers. And this distinction is not just theoretical. Those in the sex work camp are primarily concerned with protecting sex worker rights without attempting to eliminate prostitution per se. And they're generally in favour of decriminalisation of most aspects of the sex industry. In contrast, those who see prostitution as always violence against women are opposed not just to coercive or deceptive trafficking, but prostitution per se. They tend to advocate for criminal sanctions of one kind or another against persons engaged in the sale or purchase of sexual services. The former approach, that is, the prostitution as sex work, is adopted by the National Action Plan and also the perspective that I am operating from in this paper. However, as we shall see, both approaches have been important historically and continue to shape contemporary debates, policies, and laws. But just as the definition of sex trafficking is contested and politicised, so too is any attempt to be precise about the scale of the traffic. As Lisa Fadina has pointed out, many sources of literature continue to cite flawed data and some misuse research in ways that seemingly inflate the problem, which can have serious implications for anti-trafficking efforts, including victim services and anti-trafficking legislation and policy. Arguably, those interested in abolishing prostitution exaggerate the scale of the issue in order to create a moral panic and so pressure governments into action. On the other hand, their critics have identified sex trafficking as a myth, or at least a largely inflated problem. So while some commentators put the figure of people subject to forced labour or slavery at 27 million worldwide, in 2012 the ILO estimated this figure to be much less than that, at just under 21 million, although recognising that that was possibly an underestimate. Of these almost 21 million people, the ILO estimates that 58% are trafficked for the purposes of sexual exploitation, the overwhelming majority being women and girls. However, all such data must be treated with caution. The clandestine nature of trafficking means much of this activity is concealed. It's therefore impossible to obtain precise statistics. Scarlet Alliance, the peak body representing sex worker organisations in Australia, argues that trafficking is a relatively isolated phenomenon in the Australian sex industry. And this judgment is based on evidence from their membership, who are in regular contact with migrant sex workers in their workplaces. They point out that despite intensive surveillance and legislation that widen the type of offences that are now covered by anti-trafficking laws, there have been only 17 cases successfully convicted under Australia's legislation in recent years, in total, since this was introduced in 1999. The National Action Plan agrees, arguing that opportunities to traffic people into or exploit people within Australia are limited because of strong migration controls, geographic isolation, and a high degree of regulation, compliance, and enforcement. The question of migrant sex workers is separate, although related, to the question of persons trafficked to work in the sex industry. Arguably, migrant sex workers who may have come to Australia voluntarily are more vulnerable to exploitation than local workers especially when they are in Australia illegally. The stigma and sometimes illegal nature of sex work in Australia makes it difficult to be precise about the numbers working in the industry, but recent estimates put the figure at around 20,000 nationwide. Of these, a substantial proportion are believed to be migrants predominantly from Asia. But these are working under a range of employment conditions along the spectrum of free to bonded labour, and it's really difficult to be precise about exactly where the numbers fit along that spectrum. So that is the situation currently. What I wanted to do in the next part of the paper is to look at the longer term history of this issue in Australia. And as I said at the outset, it goes back to at least the last two decades of the 19th century. I think by looking at this, we can actually understand a bit more about how Australia has come to be in the position they are in now, and to actually make some assessments about how valuable the current approach is. So if we go back to the 1880s and 1890s, what we see is Australia caught up in an international movement of workers around the globe in the late 19th century, not just sex workers, but a whole range of people looking for work in different parts of the globe. The sex traffic particularly had a number of routes, and the parts that concerned Australia, there was one major route that came from Japan through Southeast Asia to Australia. It also spread out to the Pacific as far as the east coast of the Americas and as far as South Africa and Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. The other major route came from Europe through the Suez Canal to Australia, and then connected up through South America, particularly Buenos Aires, and back to Europe. So it was this I should have had a map to show you. It was a very extensive movement of workers, which accelerated after the advent of steamships, telegraphs, the Suez Canal obviously made it all much easier to move people around in response to shifting market conditions, you know, if you have mining booms and so on. People would just send or go to different places. But those two things, those two traffics, had very different kinds of conditions associated with them, and different kinds of outcomes for the women particularly involved, and different responses from the Australian authorities. So the first case study is the traffic from Japan, which is popularly known as the Karayuki-san. And that was a traffic that was from the poorer islands of Japan, where various recruiters went around. They effectively bought young girls from their parents who were impoverished, and this was the way they could actually reduce the burden on the family by selling off their girls. They would take those girls to Hong Kong, Shanghai, teach them how to work in brothels. They didn't usually put them out at the age of seven, although that's how early they recruited them. And then they transported them to various posts, as I said, throughout Southeast Asia, the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. And they ended up in Australia in mining and pearling centres, primarily of northern Australia. Now, the Australian authorities weren't too concerned about this, actually. It was quite convenient to have these coloured workers serving what was often a coloured workforce in the north. And so there was no particular interest, certainly no interest in the welfare of the women, and the traffic effectively ceased with the White Australia Policy in 1901, where they were prevented, along with other so-called coloured waters, from coming into Australia. The second traffic from Europe was more complex because it was more commonly actually individual groups of entrepreneurs travelling in small groups or individual women seeking better opportunities. There were some cases of trafficking that were exposed, and actually convictions arose from that. And those small minority of cases created a kind of moral panic around white slavery. because unlike the Japanese women who didn't fit the stereotype of the white slave, these women did. They were white and they were clearly tricked into coming to Australia. And that fed into an international panic in the late 19th, early 20th century about white slavery, and the Australian government got caught up in that and became a signatory to a series of international conventions specifically designed to stop the traffic. And the assumption behind that was that prostitution in itself was a bad thing. We must stop prostitution, and one way to stop it was actually to stop the traffic. And I won't go into the details of how Australia did that. They actually, interestingly enough, used the White Australia policy to exclude prostitutes and other entrepreneurs from the country. And the effect of that was that because they were treating all these women as trafficked, when in fact very few of them were, it had really negative effects on the women who had come to Australia, often bringing capital to set up and start a new life. They actually were migrants. But because of the actions of the government, they actually were excluded and they were forced to be on the run. And because other countries were doing this as well, by the 1920s and 30s, it was really hard for them to actually find anywhere internationally where they could find a life in the sex industry. So it was not a human rights approach. Obviously, it was not concerned really with the welfare of women, unless they happened to be that minority who were genuinely trafficked. So in conclusion, I think there are many parallels between the history of sex trafficking and migrant sex work in the late 19th and early 20th century. In both cases, there are clear examples, but they were, I think, always the minority. And the approaches taken showed a failure, I think, to actually address the welfare of the women because of the theoretical assumption that was made about sex work and prostitution. And we see in Australia a very stark contrast between the way Australia treats it as a human rights issue and, say, the way the US treats it, where George Bush linked it with the war on terror. The war on trafficking was analogous to the war on terror. Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? And the result of that is that in the US, they are determined to, they say they are determined to eliminate prostitution, so they will only give funds for groups that are explicitly anti-prostitution, which means not the sex worker groups. So, and they're the groups who actually know where the women are who are genuinely being exploited. In Australia, I think we have adopted a much better place. Isn't it nice to tell good stories about Australia? And I think that we've learnt from that experience, from our long experience, but we've also embraced the perspectives of sex worker organisations. And also, I think that Joint Parliamentary Committee took a lot of evidence from academics as well, sociologists, criminologists and historians, which actually has, I think, produced a very positive outcome. We'll see how it pans out. But I think it really is, this case is a validation of the efficacy of activism on the part of the sex worker groups and of the validation of academic research on topics of important social impact. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. If you'd like to find out more about the Society, its various branches and labour history in general, please visit www.labourhistory.org.au. Tune in next week at the same time for more talks from the conference.
Like man can't trust his kind today. Love has died and death is here to stay. Guess all that can fade away on a cloud so far away. Time will come when death will pave the way. All is gone from love that is. Yeah. Sell your soul and live, that is the way. So you'll stop and fade away on the clouds so far away, in a world that we can be what we say. You better stop, look and listen. You're going damn fast and your time has failed. You better stop, look and listen. It's your last chance, you're on this green grass. Time is up, you better move away. On a cloud, the journey's far away. Live a life of love with me. It will last eternally. Know a love that's new and also free. To move away. On our cloud, the journey's far away. Come with me and fade away. Live and love another day. Time will come when death will pave the way. Time will come when death will.
I don't want to be afraid when Father Time ticks in the hour. There is no way out, so I'll sit and wait and watch and wonder. See the fogs of fate coming on down, coming on down. Churchmen lost their way now. The Indian mystic man was crying out in shame.
And you couldn't see the night for the deathly shining light
that's all around. As I sit and watch my room, yellow floor, yellow wall, pink ceiling,
thinking back to when all that troubled meant was fear of dying.
See the fogs of fate coming on down, coming on down. Peace all is too late, coming on down, coming on down. People in the pop world were complaining, the deadly fallout kept away the crowds.
And the children, they sang with their lollipops in hand. Dustmen couldn't see the ground, people falling all around. And the wise man, he said, look around and see the dead,
they're coming round.